Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Gondard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He describes the action as choppy. He takes a look at crude, gold, and the Russell 2000. Ross also has a special offer for you. The founder of thetrendletter.com, Martin Straith, weighs in on interest rates, inflation, the future of the U.S. dollar, crude, and Germany's insane switch from atomic power to coal. He also has a special offer for you. Publisher of WolfStreet.com, Wolf Richter, examines the possibility of recession, vacant office towers and their impact on the economy, pressure on the U.S. banking system, and the vehicle market. Plus, at the end of the show, we'll have a company showcase update from Recyclico CEO Zarko Misalgia. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at chartsbyross. Welcome back to the show, Ross.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
Ross, do we have a special offer for our listeners?
Yeah, for the next 2 weeks, we're offering 25% off for new subscribers taking out an annual subscription. So if they go over to the website, chartsandmarkets.com, it's right up there on the front page, and we welcome you aboard. And if you just want a trial offer, we've got one there that is good for 2 months. You can take a look at the research and hopefully come in and take out the annual subscription.
Russ, what happened on the major markets this past week?
Well, we're into earnings season. So, you know, you got a lot of choppy action. You'll get one or two stocks with good earnings, a couple with bad, and the markets overall pretty, as I say, choppy week because of that. No really big net gains. The NASDAQ is still managing to hold just above the highs that we saw last fall, but you know, it's the only index that's really has done too much on the upside. You take a look at the S&P or the Dow, you're challenging the old highs from last year, or last fall, but it's once again, as we've talked about, it's a really select group of stocks that's doing it. It's the Microsofts, the Amazon, the Meta platforms. Those have been really pulling the S&P up. It's half a dozen stocks out of 500. Without those, the S&P would be flat or down on the year. So it's you got to be selective in your stock selections. And, you know, just in this last 10 days or so, we're starting to get upside exhaustion warnings on big stocks like Meta looking for pretty decent corrections here. We're passing through the second best month of the year, April. May is typically the one where you want to make sure that you put some cash in your pocket and be ready to spend that if we get a little bit of a summer rally. Maybe you get a bounce in July, but you know, classically that October, November will become the next great buying opportunity.
What's going on with crude?
So here's one where we've had really big rally off the bottom, off to 62 and change, got up to 84. So when you've been as oversold as the oil market was, you know, remembering that, you know, this was just $120 last April, May, and it had spiked to 130 during March of last year. So this low that we put in and the rally off the bottom is just the classic initial reaction off major lows. And what you see is as of this week, we've now pulled back down to about just under 77. And that's not quite a 38% retracement from the bottom. And historically, if we look back over the last 10, 20, 30 years, for lows like we've just put in a month and a half ago, once that first rally is in place, you can look to buy the first oversold, and you could use a short-term RSI, like a nine-day RSI. We use the Commodity Channel Index, getting down into minor oversold readings as of Thursday and Friday, as we approach the 38% retracement, which would be around 76 and a quarter. So we're getting into the point where you want to be deploying some more money back into energy for a retest of that $84 level that we saw a week and a half ago.
What's happening with gold?
Gold, you know, upside exhaustion that we had in place here on the that good rally a month and a half ago. And since then, just had minor highs, so you're starting to see some pretty good divergences as far as the oscillators are concerned, like the RSI and the demand index and the commodity channel index, as it managed to just push through the 2040 and then through 2060, but couldn't hold. So, you know, we're closing off this week. Futures contracts down under 2,000 and probably due for a pretty decent pullback in here right now. Wouldn't be doing too much on the as far as picking up the metals as of now. Take a look at something like the GDX, the mining stock index. Definitely saw a divergent high on the top. And this was, you know, a few weeks ago, the most overbought that we had seen since March of last year when it had a big correction. So, you know, stand on the sidelines for a little while longer. You want to see a deeper break, maybe into the 1950 level or lower, but at this point, don't want to put an actual number on it. We'll see how it does in terms of getting an oversold reading that you can take advantage of.
What's happening with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
So the Canadian traded along with commodities in general, you know, the oil market. The Canadian is probably looking at, you know, a minor interim low here. We had trouble at 75. If we get a bounce of the oil and maybe a bounce over in the agricultural commodities, and get a bounce back, maybe retest that 75-cent level on the Canadian dollar.
What's happening in the junior markets like the Russell 2000?
Well, you know, here's, you know, when we take a look at how it's been a small group of stocks in the big cap names that have taken it on the upside, if we take a look at something like the Russell 2000, it has really just not managed to do much at all. The bounce in the Russell 2000 has been pretty mediocre. We take a look at where it was in February, and we take a look back to a year ago. This thing is just not had. It's all been dead cat bounces all the way along, and just in this last second part of the calendar quarter. The rally, you know, from the, on the IWM, you know, we dropped from 200 down to 170, only got back to 180. So it managed to, even when everything else was managing to test the highs of the year, the Russell has only retraced about a third of its drop. And it was suspect that if the overall market has some pressure, that the Russell is going to manage to put in new lows before we can blink an eye.
Ross, can you remind us about that special offer again?
Yeah, we're doing 25% off on annual subscriptions, and that's good for the next 2 weeks. And, you know, welcome aboard, everybody.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Coming up, Martin Strath next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
My guest is Martin Straight, founder of Trend News online at thetrendletter.com. He's speaking to us from Coquitlam, British Columbia, which is just east of Vancouver. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thanks, Jim. Good to be here.
Martin, inflation seems to be coming down here in Canada, the U.S., Europe. What are your thoughts on whether inflation will drop to the 2% level both the Bank of Canada and the Fed are targeting?
Yeah, you know, each week we update a chart showing the central bank rate and the inflation rate for a number of countries. Most central banks have stated that they want, you know, one of their main goals is they want their real rate to be positive, meaning that they want the central bank rate higher than inflation. For over the past year now, on our chart, only three countries, Brazil, Mexico, and China, have had a real rate that was positive. But now, as of this week, Canada now has a real rate that's positive. So meaning that the central bank rate is 4.5%, inflation is now 4.3%, so the real rate is positive 0.20%. In the U.S., the real rate has dropped back into neutral last week, so that the Fed rate and the inflation rate are both at 5%. So now as to whether inflation drops to 2% for both Canada and U.S., we think that's going to take longer than most believe. You know, we can see maybe the high 3%, 3.5%, but to get it down to 2 by the end of this year, I don't, you know, it could happen, I guess, but I don't think so. Because remember, one of the key reasons for the dramatic rise in inflation has been government spending. You know, the trillions of dollars governments globally spent on COVID relief packages was a major driver of inflation. So while the Bank of Canada and the Fed keep trying to control inflation with the rate hikes and so on, the federal governments in both countries continue to spend, neither having any desire to reduce spending. You know, Canada, the recent budget, the Liberals canceled their previous promise to balance the budget by 2027. And instead, by their own projections, they're going to add over $50 billion more debt. In the U.S., they're racking up deficits of $1.5, $1.6 trillion every year. And right now, they're in the process of negotiating, you know, an increase in their debt ceiling. And they're, you know, the Republicans have already offered $1.5 trillion. So this would be the 79th time in 63 years that they will raise the debt limit. I mean, you've got to wonder why they even bother having a limit, given that they never comply with it. And, you know, and by the way, it doesn't matter which party's in office. They just raise it every time. And all this government spending it's all inflationary. And the big key thing, you know, people are all excited inflation's coming down and so on. So, but inflation, falling inflation doesn't mean prices are falling. It just means that the rate of prices rising is slowing. So in 2022, inflation in Canada was 8.1%. Last month, it dropped down to 4.3%. So while it's lower now than the previous year, it's still rising. And over the 2 years, it's risen, you know, 12.4%. And remember, you know, food inflation has been even higher. You know, it's more up in the 10%. So yeah, I mean, you know, inflation has been dropping, which is good. But, you know, down to 2%, I think that's going to take quite a bit longer.
The Bank of Canada has paused their central bank rate the last two meetings. What do you expect the Fed to do at their May meeting?
Well, as I just mentioned, I mean, the Fed now has a neutral real rate. So if they were to raise rates, you know, 0.25% in May, then their real rate would be positive. So that should take some pressure off, you know, more rate hikes for now. You know, generally, we've got the bond market has been betting that the long-term yields are going to decline. Well, at the same time, we've had the Fed raising rates in the short term. You know, we discussed this before, but this, I mean, the result of this is an inverted yield curve, and that's been a very reliable predictor of a recession. So, as you say, the Bank of Canada has paused for the last two meetings, so I would expect the Fed will probably raise, you know, 0.25% at their May meeting, and then they would pause. And after May, I think that for both countries, both central banks, it makes a lot of sense to then just sit back and watch and see what the lagging effect of all of this tightening has been. Now, you know, that's what I'm saying, that the market disagrees with us, and they continue to fight the Fed on whether the Fed is going to cut. You know, the market right now is pricing in an 81% odds of a 2.25% hike in May, but they also project that the Fed rate hike is going to drop to 4.48% by year end. So they're pricing in over a 0.5% cut. Now, the Fed is saying there is going to be no cuts this year. So far, the Fed has stuck to their guns. So we'll just have to see how this plays out.
There's been a lot of talk lately that the U.S. dollar is losing its reserve currency status. Do you think that's possible?
Last week, we had the president of Brazil. He was in China, and so he was wondering why all the countries are being forced to trade in the U.S. dollar. You know, we're seeing a real fragmentation of global economy into these competing blocks now. You know, when the West pushed Russia out of the SWIFT banking system, it really signaled to countries that were not good buddies with the U.S. and the West that the SWIFT system is now being politicized. So now we've got Russia, China, the other BRIC countries, we've got Saudi Arabia, Iran, and other countries taking on alternative systems and trading in things like the Chinese renminbi. But, you know, while countries are looking to trade in other currencies, we don't see the U.S. losing its world reserve currency status anytime soon. It's not really countries that trade. I mean, it's generally companies, it's businesses, it's farmers, et cetera. So, you know, these presidents and these different politicians can say, well, we don't want to trade in this currency or that. But, you know, these businesses want to trade in the U.S. dollar because it's the most liquid market in the world. You know, does a Brazilian soybean farmer who exports to China want to get paid in the Chinese renminbi? I mean, what would he do with it? You know, he buys nothing from the Chinese merchant. So who does he trade these renminbis with? So he can't go and use them to go buy food at the grocery store, or he can't go to the local gas station to buy gas. No, he wants U.S. dollars because everybody accepts them. And it's recognized as the most liquid currency market in the world. It's also backed by the world's largest financial market. So, you know, governments will make deals. I mean, they buy each other's bonds, et cetera. And they, you know, governments will, you know, buy things like weapons and so on. But in the big picture, it's primarily businesses who trade, not governments. So for the foreseeable future, most are going to continue to want to trade in the U.S. dollar and not in Chinese or Russian currencies. Now, China does own almost $900 billion of U.S. bonds, and they have been selling those, and that does put pressure on the U.S. dollar. But for the U.S. dollar to lose reserve currency status, you know, yes, it will happen at some point, but not anytime soon.
Are Canada and the U.S. heading for a recession?
Well, if you listen to the talking heads on TV, you would think no. But we look at a couple of historically accurate leading economic indicators, and they are saying we are heading for a recession. You know, I think I mentioned last time I was on, you know, back since 1955, there's only been one time where the yield curve has been inverted without there being a recession. And today, the yield curve is inverted more than it's been in 40 years. You know, also, there's been zero times when the inflation ran over 5% with an inverted yield curve that did not result in a recession. So again, until this week, inflation was been over 5% for months and months, and the yield curve is, you know, more inverted than it's been in 40 years. So there's one, you know, the yield curve is definitely screaming a recession. And then in addition, this week, we've got the Conference Board's leading economic index. It fell to its lowest level since November of 2020. And in their forecast, they state that the economic weakness is going to intensify and spread more widely throughout the U.S. economy over the coming months. And they're saying it's going to lead to a recession by mid-2023. Well, I mean, we're in late April here. So, you know, mid-2023 is not very far away. And the big key here is in over 40 plus years, every time that indicator drops below zero and stays there for two or more months, a recession has followed 100% of the time. Well, that index has been below zero now for over 6 months. So I don't know, maybe this time's different, but we doubt it, and we would expect to see be in a recession by the fall.
What do you see ahead for the stock markets?
Well, I mean, the S&P 500's been bullish since October. It's up, 15, 16%. But, you know, the average stock is only up about 2%. And that's because, you know, the eight big tech stocks have accounted for most of the rise in the S&P 500. So those other 492 stocks are barely breaking even. So it's a very distorted bullish rally here. The S&P right now, I just looked at, well, it's got resistance near 41.75. Today it was trading about 41.30 here on Friday. So we're looking at, you know, about 45 points below that next resistance level. Now, 4,300 was the August high. And if we were to hit that, we would expect that that would be the high near term. Because we see now, we see some headwinds. So, you know, we're looking at, you know, a slowing global economy, likely a global recession. We've got geopolitical tensions. I mean, we've got Ukraine, Russia, we got China and Taiwan. We got China and Russia versus the West. We've got the Middle East. We've got North Korea. I mean, if we get an escalation of any of those, it's not going to be good for the stock market. So investors really need to be careful there. Jim, last time I was on, about a month ago, I mentioned that our models had forecast a turning point around mid-April. Well, that's where we are now. So we expect we're going to see some directional change here very soon. So the key now is, so, you know, what could that mean? Well, one thing could be that if the S&P breaks above that 41.75 I mentioned, then it could blast higher. But if it declines here and falls below 39.40, then watch out, because I think we could see a steep decline. So we have a chart that we keep showing our subscribers, and it highlights that when the Fed is in a rate hike cycle, like they are right now, the bottom of the market aligns when the Fed stops cutting rates, not when it stops raising them. And this is a very key point. So right now, everybody's all excited because they think maybe one more rate hike and then the Fed's going to pause. And typically, when the Fed pauses, the markets get it. We see an uptick in the market because everybody's all excited because the Fed's going to pause and they're probably going to cut. But the key is, and what the chart shows so clearly, is that when the Fed starts cutting, that is when the big losses start to happen. And if you think about it, it kind of makes a lot of sense. The reason the Fed starts cutting is because the economy is in trouble and most likely headed for a recession. So investors dump the stocks because the stocks do not do well in a recession. So markets typically fall as the rates cut, and not until the Fed stops cutting rates do we see the stocks start to rise again. Jim, I'll post this chart in our market minutes or our market notes blog later today so that your listeners can have a look at it. They need to be careful, have a good look at that chart.
Gold and silver have done well. What do you see ahead for the precious metals?
Yeah. Interesting that there seems to be $20 million worth of gold missing from the Toronto airport. But you're right. Gold and silver have had a terrific run here. Gold reaching 2063 on April 13th. Now, silver has done even better, which is typical in a bullish trend for precious metals. You know, in bull markets, silver typically outperforms gold. And then in bear markets, silver typically underperforms. So one thing that we have been watching is that the mining stocks have been lagging the metals. So that is something that we really want to keep an eye on. Now, in last week's report to subscribers, we noted that gold was overbought. Now, this week, gold has dropped to that 2,000 level, which has been a nice little bit of support here. But here today, on Friday, that support level just failed, and gold is now down about 30 bucks left. I looked at about 1990. So, but that's okay, because we see that as a healthy pullback. We'd like to actually see a bigger pullback after such a big run. So we're looking at 1950 as near-term support level for gold. And, you know, we think gold and silver are going to continue to outperform the S&P 500 for the next couple of years. You know, one of the big drivers for gold, I keep saying this, but it's going to be the loss of confidence investors have in government. You know, the recent banking crisis, that's certainly fed into that narrative, and it really fueled gold and silver's run over the last 6 weeks. People are really starting to question the competency of these politicians and bureaucrats and their ability to manage the economy. And I think that once that confidence is broken, we can expect to see gold rise along with the U.S. dollar as safe haven plays. And if we get a real nice correction here, it's going to be another really good buying opportunity.
The last time you were on, you had just recommended six oil plays, and that was pretty good timing. What do you see ahead for crude, natural gas, and gasoline?
Yeah, we like energy. We've liked it for a while. Yes, up until mid-March, we had been telling subscribers to hold off buying any oil or oil stocks until we saw oil get under the $70 and into the low mid-60 range. And that did happen. That happened mid-March. And as you said, we added those six new stocks. Then, of course, we had OPEC announce their big production cuts. So that pushed oil up over $82. So, I mean, in a fairly short span, we saw the price jump over 25%. But since then, I mean, oil's pulled back now. Our models are actually looking for oil to dip down into the low to mid-70s. Now, short-term, if we do get a recession, that's going to hit demand, and that's going to push prices lower. But again, if that happens, it's going to present another really good buying opportunity. And then in the longer term, you know, on the supply side, you know, we've got China opening up. We've got India expanding. I mean, those are two massive markets. And then on the supply side, you've got governments imposing, you know, they're continuing to impose their windfall taxes, their tight regulations, you know, no new drilling permits, you know, all disincentives for producers. We've got capital expenditures are down to 35-year lows. So all of that lack of investment in the sector is going to cause serious supply problems long term. So, you know, longer term, we expect oil is going to have a really good next few years. Certainly, we're going to see $100 oil, potentially, you know, $150 and even higher over the next few years. Now, gasoline, you know, based on seasonality, we typically see a strong rally from mid-March into June. Starting mid-March, we saw gasoline start to rally just a bit on cue. But in the last week, it's been trailing off, so we need to keep an eye on that. Now, natural gas has been a real disappointment. You know, it's always been very volatile, always been very weather dependent, and the warmer than normal winter really caused prices to crash. You know, we had that crazy run up on natural gas through the European energy crisis. You know, prices over in Europe were crazy, but even in North America, they got up to $9.50 in August. Well, they're down to $2.25 today. So, you know, again, natural gas, typically we see a rise from early March to mid-June. So far, we haven't seen that seasonal spike as there's been, you know, there's a ton of supply and weak demand. But, you know, it is sort of basing around that 2205 range. You know, hopefully we could get a little spike there. You know, maybe up to $3, maybe $3.25 range, get a little, little jump there.
Last weekend, Germany shut down its last three atomic power plants. What do you see ahead for nuclear?
Yeah, that was quite shocking. You know, when we just witnessed, the panic of that energy crisis in Germany and Europe, and then here we are. You know, in the year 2000, nuclear power provided 30% of Germany's power consumption. Now they just shut down all of those nuclear power stations. So here we have a country claiming that it wants to curb greenhouse gas emissions, but at the same time, it just shut down all of its nuclear power stations that produce zero greenhouse gas emissions. And the crazy part, to replace those zero emission nuclear power, Germany has turned to coal, the dirtiest of fuels, and now coal produced 37% of Germany's electricity in 2022. Now, this is all despite pleas from a collection of these esteemed climate scientists, including two Nobel laureates, who continue to ask them to continue to use zero-emission nuclear and not use coal. But the government ignored those pleas. So one of the scientists, his name was Hahn von Storck, and he said, for me, as a climate scientist, this whole thing is incomprehensible. And, you know, it's really pretty hard to argue with them. So but going forward, you know, to me, what we've got is that, you know, generating electricity with nuclear reactors does not create any greenhouse gases. And as a global climate change response efforts continue to fall short of all their targets, nuclear energy is now getting renewed consideration. So we just saw over right now, over 30 countries, including the UK, France, and Portugal, they're looking to expand nuclear as a green source of power. Now, one thing that's interesting is that Germany says that solar and wind will produce 80% of their power by the year 2030. So we're talking of less than 7 years from now. The IEA, they project that the clean energy sector's demand for things like copper, cobalt, graphite, lithium, you know, other rare earths and so on, is going to increase from 10 to 40 times. So that's a lot of mining required in regions that have not been, supportive of granting new permits. So the question is, where's all this, these materials going to come from? And the other big question that I never hear getting answered is, when the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing, where is the power going to come from? Now, one of the things that was very interesting, I just saw a Gallup poll this week, and it was titled Americans Slow to Adapt to Electric Vehicles. And in it, what they did is they asked these the respondents to classify in four different categories where they would fit. So relating to EV vehicles, the first category was that you currently own one. Then it was seriously considering buying one. Then it was might consider in the future, and then would not buy. So of the proponents or the respondents, currently own was 4%. Seriously considering owning was 12%. So the 16% were between currently own and seriously considering. Might consider in the future was 43%. And definitely would not buy was 41%. So I think they've got a lot of selling to do on this whole EV thing, because it doesn't look like the masses are jumping to it.
Martin, where can people find out more about the trend letter?
Well, I can, as I mentioned, Jim, I'll post some of these charts that I've referenced here on the site. So your listeners can go to the trend letter. So all one word, thetrendletter.com. Hit on the blog tab and then go to the trend letter blog. So at the bottom of that page, I will post some links for some special offers so your listeners can get deals from 40 up to 65%, depending whether they go for a single service or a combination. Also, we do have our free daily headline service. This is where we review what's happening in the markets every morning, and we send out the headlines that we think investors really need to be aware of. And, if they sign up for that, they don't need to worry about getting spam sent to them. We don't believe in spam. We don't do it. So you're not going to get constantly receiving spam that you get from so many other services trying to sell you on everything. If they have any questions, just simply send it to us at info@thetrendletter.com.
Martin, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
My pleasure, Jim. Take care.
My guest has been Martin Straith, founder of Trend News Online at thetrendletter.com. He was speaking to us from Coquitlam, British Columbia. Coming up, Wolf Richter, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Wolf Richter, publisher of wolfstreet.com. He's speaking to us from San Francisco. Wolf, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thanks for having me back, Jim.
Wolf, can you tell people just a little bit about Wolf Street, what you guys do?
Wolfstreet.com, it's finance, business, and money. That's all we talk about here. It is free. There's no paywall. You don't have to sign up for anything. Wolfstreet.com. Just join us. Have a vibrant, well-behaved comment section too. So take a look.
Wolf, will the U.S. have a recession this year?
Well, it looks like it. You know, it's the most predicted recession ever, and it has even shown up in the Federal Reserve's minutes of its last meeting. The Federal Reserve, I don't think, has ever predicted a recession. And now just about every economist predicts it. Various measures that predict recessions have predicted it for over a year, like the inverted yield curve has been predicting it for over a year. And there's all kinds of stuff wobbling, and we had a few banks blow up, and you know, there's this, that, and the other, and yet the consumer is just still hanging in there. You know, they're fully employed, the wages have gone up, they're working, unemployment is very low, they're spending money. They're not spending money on goods anymore. That was the pandemic thing. Now they're spending money on services, on travels, on all kinds of other service, discretionary service, and things they really need, and healthcare and those kinds of things. And so we've got this situation where the consumer is really strong, and buying stuff, spending money, and surprising everybody along the way. There was a slowdown late last year in consumer spending, but this year it's picked up so far. And so now there's this question, what if we don't have a recession? You know, I mean, Wall Street has been begging for a recession. The idea is that the Fed will cut interest rates if we have a recession, and hopefully we'll start quantitative easing again, meaning printing money. And I mean, that's kind of the hope that Wall Street really wants. And Wall Street really hates those high interest rates. And so they're all praying for a recession, ironically. So if we don't get a recession, and the Fed may not cut it, and there are no interest rate cuts on the table anyway. I mean, the Fed has denied that. And so that, you know, Wall Street's hoping for a big fat recession, so to knock the Fed off its perch there. And but if we don't get one, you know, if the economy continues to muddle through with the consumer continuing to spend, and you know, and the rest of the economy holding up reasonably well, you know, the Fed's not going to do anything. It might hike interest rates further. We've got another rate hike coming up here in early May, and then there's possible one in June. And if inflation is hanging in there, which it has been, so the underlying inflation in services and core inflation in the United States have reached very high levels and have moved sideways. They really haven't come down. So, you know, the Fed's very concerned about that. So there's a very good chance that if we don't get a recession, you know, that inflation will go even higher, and that interest rates will stay high for longer and may go higher. And Wall Street just hates the prospect. So that we're in this ironic situation where Wall Street really wants a recession, and so that the Fed will cut interest rates. And yet when we have a recession, typically, you know, stocks lose a lot of ground. And there's some bloodletting going on when we do have a recession, and for quite a while. So this is a very bizarre and ironic situation that we now have, with a big part of economists and Wall Street clamoring for a recession, while the consumer says, oh, everything's fine, we're making lots of money, we're working, we're spending it, you know, and we're enjoying our lives and doing all the things we want to do. So I'm starting to doubt that we will have a recession. I mean, it's the most predicted recession ever. And when you predict something with this certainty, it tends to not arrive. So, this is going to be very interesting to watch. And if we don't get a recession, you know, I think Wall Street is in a world of hurt.
There's a lot of talk about central banks raising their inflation targets. What would happen to the markets if the Fed raised its inflation target from 2% to, say, something like 4 or 5%?
Yeah, the idea is that, to get to 2%, the Fed would have to really crack down on inflation, so raise interest rates much higher and keep them there for much longer, and cause a real recession that would bring the inflation rate down to 2%, because there's just not a historical incident where inflation goes to 8-9%, and then within a year and a half it's back to 2% without some major dramatic intervention by the central bank. And so there's a very good chance that this inflation is not going to 2% at the current monetary policy. And so a lot of people are worried that to get it to 2%, the Fed will have to follow policies that are very harsh on the economy. And to avoid that, they said that the Fed should raise or will raise its inflation target to 4 or 5%, and then it wouldn't have to crack down. But you know, this is also ironic because as soon as it becomes official that the Fed will let that targeting an inflation rate of 4% or 5%, the illusion goes away that inflation will go to 2%. Right now, long-term interest rates are pegged on the notion that by later this year or early next year, sometime next year, you know, inflation rate is going to be below 3%, and it's going to hit 2% next year. And so the 10-year yield is based on that. The 10-year Treasury yield is based on the idea that very shortly we will have 2% inflation. And so the 10-year yield is at 3.5% based on this idea that it'll be a little bit above the 2% inflation target and inflation rate that we'll have in a few years. So if the Fed comes out and says, okay, forget 2%, you know, forget all that. That was so yesterday. Now we've got 4% inflation in our future, that's our target, 4 or 5%. We're happy with that. You know, we're not going to aggressively pursue that. That moment, you will have bond investors look at this and say, holy moly, we have figured that we have 2% inflation. Now the Fed says, no, it's going to be 4% for years out, and we won't do anything unless it gets much higher. And they're going to reprice those bonds. And they're going to figure, okay, if it's 4% inflation for many years, we want to be above that with our yield. So the yield should be around 6% and maybe higher, maybe 7% on the 10-year. And so you'll see the 10-year yield essentially double from 3.5% to probably around 7% in mortgage rates. The typical 30-year fixed mortgage rate in the United States runs a little higher than the 10-year yield, so it will be at 9%. So people who wish for the Fed to raise its policy target to 4 or 5%. Yeah, they need to think about what long-term rates will do when the Fed does it. I mean, the only reason why long-term rates are so low is because the market still has confidence that the Fed can bring long-term interest rates or inflation down to 2%. And if that confidence disappears, if the confidence is changing toward inflation is going to be 4 or 5% for the next 10 years, you know, then all the long-term rates will adjust, meaning prices will go down and yields will go up. And that's not just bonds; it'll be commercial real estate, it'll be all kinds of other prices, it'll be stocks. You know, this is one of the crucial element in many of the high asset prices we have, is that we haven't had a lot of inflation, and when we get more inflation, you need higher yields to compensate you for it, and then investors will demand higher yields. That brings prices down by definition. So this will be a very tough thing. If the Fed does that, if the Fed actually says, okay, 4 or 5% is good with us, this will be a very harsh thing for the bond market, for the commercial real estate market, for stocks too. You know, I mean, who wants to have a dividend yield of 2%? Based on the idea that inflation is 2%, when now inflation is 4%, and you know you would lose a huge bunch of value in stocks too. So this is a very dangerous thing, I think, to promote.
Are we living in kind of a different time here? Even though we're talking recession in the U.S., there are still just under 10 million job openings in Canada, just under a million. Even if people are laid off, there are so many employers desperate for employees. Could this be a different kind of recession where maybe the stock markets aren't going up, but people still have jobs?
Yeah, so recession really means, in the United States at least, it means a broad-based decline of economic activities, not just GDP, but also employment. And other factors, yeah, particularly the labor market figures heavily into our definition, official definition of a recession, and it has for decades. It's been that way forever. And so when you get a GDP decline for, like we had in early 2022, we had, in the United States, we had a GDP decline, but that was based on a surge in imports. Imports are negative on GDP. And so because consumers were buying so many imported goods, we had this explosion in imports, and that turned a GDP briefly into a negative figure. But it wasn't an economic decline by any means. I mean, consumer spending was strong. Everything was strong except for this figure of imports. And so that was not a recession in that sense. And so if you have a strong labor market, it is very unlikely that we will get a recession. And yeah, with a strong labor market, inflation won't come down either. So that's the problem. You know, the strong labor market means we've lost a lot of the labor force. So, you know, there's huge demand for labor and not enough labor to fill those jobs. And in a way, that's good for labor, you know, because now they can arbitrage that. Workers can arbitrage that and they get better jobs and they can change industries and they can move from low wage industries to high industries. So that's been very good for workers. So, you know, that has been one of the best things for workers in decades. So that's a good thing, but it does, fuel inflation further. And, you know, so I don't know that you can call this a recession if we continue to have a tight labor market. You know, that's just going, you know, for the U.S. definition of a recession, that's just not going to probably happen. The labor market is now cooling a little bit. I mean, just a tiny little bit. It's back where it was in some measures during the strong period before the pandemic. The job openings are still huge, and people are still quitting jobs in very large numbers to find better jobs. Yeah, there's a lot of churns on the labor force. So the tightness is still persists, but there are some signs that there are some cooling going on. A lot of the tech and social media firms, they've announced global layoffs. So they're laying off people in all countries, but including in the United States. So we've seen a few of those layoffs now in California, San Francisco particularly. So there's a little bit of cooling going on, so this could very well be a mild recession, for example, with a relatively strong labor market that's cooling somewhat. If we get a recession, we might not get a recession and just have a labor market that goes back to normal. That might be another option, you know. And of course, you always have the black swan event that could show up and could turn this into a big mess. And I don't see that, but I mean, there's always a possibility that this could happen, and suddenly everything blows up and you have this huge gigantic recession. But I just don't see that.
With a significant amount of the workforce continuing to work from home, what could this mean for office towers, and to what extent are U.S. banks exposed to commercial real estate debt?
Yeah, that's a that's a structural problem. You know, that has nothing to do with a recession or with inflation or with anything else. This is a structural problem that started many years ago. What big companies did is they expected to grow, and this sped up during the pandemic, and they figured we have this exponential growth, and so they were leasing and building office space like maniacs. Yeah, that's for years. And companies like Google and Facebook and all these companies were out there, and that would lease a whole office tower because they thought a few years from now they would need it. And that tower was essentially empty. And they would lease entire floors, you know, waiting to grow into it. So they were counting on a future, and that future obviously didn't come. And so then I shifted to working from home part of it. Now they're cutting back on office space. They're laying people off. And so San Francisco, for example, went from the tightest office market in the country with vacancy rates of the mid-single digits of 7-8%, you know, in the office market, to the worst office market in the country with about a one-third of all office space now being vacant and on the market for lease. And, you know, there is no demand there at all. Companies are still moving out. You know, They switch to working from home. When the leases expire, they don't renew them. So you have that in commercial leases. These are 10-year leases a lot of times. So company generally doesn't walk out on the lease. They will sublease or try to find somebody to move into their space. So they sublease it. And they don't really care what they get for a sublease. They just won't have somebody in it. So that puts downward pressure on rent. And there's really no solution to that other than converting some of the office towers into residential. Those that can be converted, they're not many. There's only a few. The office towers that were built in the 1980s, they're very difficult or impossible to convert. They essentially will have to be torn down. And that's what we're seeing. I mean, we're seeing office towers sold at foreclosure that leaves $0 for the lenders. For example, the one AT&T Center in St. Louis, a huge office tower in St. Louis, Missouri, it finally sold its foreclosure for next to nothing. And after fees and expenses, the debt holders got nothing, and there, some developer bought it and they're going to have to redevelop it. It's a huge problem in San Francisco. Downtown is still like a ghost town. Many of these towers will just have to be torn down and then converted in the new tower built for residential purposes. This can't be done at a high cost when the tower is purchased at a high cost, so they have to buy it in a foreclosure sale for just a few cents on the dollar, and then they can tear it down and essentially for the land value, they're buying it for the land value, and then they build a new one. And there's some, we're converting some now, and there's some of that in progress, but it's very slow, and we're talking about many, many years for that to play out. And that will be a good change. Putting residential towers into downtowns will be great. I mean, that's what downtowns need, and that will be a really good thing to do. So I'm looking forward to that, but it's just a horrible thing to have to go through at this point. And thank goodness, so far, the defaults have hit mostly investors, not banks, of these office towers. So all the big office defaults that we've seen so far have hit commercial mortgage-backed securities and not banks. And which gives me the feeling, that the banks kept the better loans and the worst loans were securitized and sold off to investors in slices like that. And the banks are really not that exposed to this office part of commercial real estate. Overall, U.S. banks hold about 45% of the total real estate debt, and they may hold better slices. Because they have first dibs on this, and so they may have gotten less aggressive, and they have just gone after the good parts of the business, and private equity firms and other companies, life insurance companies, and so forth may have been more aggressive and gone after the weaker commercial real estate debt. And, banks securitize a lot of that debt, so they package it into structured securities, and they sell those to investors, so they shuffled off a lot of those risks. So banks don't look like they're going to be on the hook for a lot of this. There are over 4,000 banks in the United States, so what commercial real estate debt they have is spread over 4,000 banks. I just looked at Morgan Stanley report yesterday. They have $8 billion in commercial mortgage-backed, in commercial real estate debt on their books, $8 billion of commercial real estate debt. So if that debt goes to zero overnight, if it just vanishes, the Morgan Stanley would still break even for the year. They make so much money. All these big banks make so much money that essentially their holdings of commercial real estate debt would just wipe out the profits for a certain period of time. It wouldn't really do that much damage to the bank. The smaller banks are more exposed to it, but they're more exposed to residential projects than office properties. So, we're going to have some bank failures. because of commercial real estate, but it's going to be smaller banks. And we always have some failures in the United States every year almost. You know, we have, even in the best times, we have three or four smaller banks, eight smaller banks in some years that fail and are taking over, you know. So that's really not a huge deal. With the riskier commercial real estate debt, it's investors that are on the hook.
What's the latest on the housing markets in Canada and the U.S.?
Yeah, we're in spring selling season. You know, I mean, like every spring, we see prices go up. And, you know, they didn't go up enough in March. And so year over year, prices are down in both Canada and the United States. Canada is ahead. They're down a lot year over year in Canada. In the United States, we just had our second dip in year over year in March. We just got that today. So, you know, volume is up, but not enough. So compared to a year ago, volume is still down by 20%. This is still a fairly dismal level of sales. The high mortgage rates are not helping. This is the best time of the year, and it's just not looking very good.
Could interest rates be in the eye of the hurricane, poised to head higher? In other words, calm right now, but then the eye wall hits.
Yeah, so Bank of Canada obviously is pausing, has been pausing. The Fed will eventually pause. I mean, interest rates cannot go up forever, so we'll have one or two more rate hikes before it pauses, probably. And pausing means that they will hold the rate steady for a while to see what inflation does. And then if inflation goes back to 2%, which really I don't expect, you know, but if it does, you know, eventually, so next year maybe, or year after next year, central banks may start lowering the rates again. But if inflation continues to be nasty, and if it resurges, as it does, you know, the inflation is a game of whack-a-mole. You think you got it down, and then something else pops up, you know. So if there's a resurgence in inflation, central banks are now pretty leery because there's been so much money printing. We're sitting on a powder keg, you know, with inflation. There has been so much money printing in recent years, that is now getting unleashed. And so this is going to be very difficult to control when it takes off. So the central banks have gotten to be very nervous about this in Europe the same way, you know. So if we have another nasty surprise from inflation, I'm pretty sure that central banks will hike again and hike further, because when inflation takes off after 14 years really of money printing in the United States and in Europe, you know, it is just impossible really to knuckle back under without some really big measures. It could be that that's the scenario we're going to get, that we have another resurgence of inflation and that therefore interest rates will go higher from here. But, you know, I don't see that happening right now. So in the next few months, I think they're going to be fairly benign. Inflation in the United States has the core inflation and service inflation has moved sideways at very, very high levels at over twice the Fed's target range. So, and it hasn't come down. So, all the declines we have seen were in energy products. They've plunged, you know, and we've seen some declines in food prices, and we have seen some price declines in some goods like electronics and used cars. And we have seen big price increases in services all around, and we've seen price increases in some other goods. So right now, some important things have declined. You know, food and energy is very important. But that's not the underlying inflation. So the underlying inflation still tells central banks, you know, this is a powder keg. We need to be very careful. And if we get a major increases in service inflation or in core inflation, I think they will rise further.
Are auto loans a canary in the coal mine for mortgage rates?
But so, you know, the prime auto loan, so the people with good credit history, you know, they're in very good, a pristine condition. There's a small sector that we call subprime, and these are people with spotty credit histories, with low credit scores, and especially the low end of that is now seeing some difficulties. We have a whole industry that has grown up that specialized in subprime selling of older used vehicles. So the subprime customers, they buy older used vehicles. So they're often, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 12 years old, and they pay very high interest rates. And, you know, they're really getting ripped off by this industry and the specialized subprime industry. And then, you know, they make payments for a while and they stop making payments because they know they got ripped off. They got ripped off on price. They're paying, you know, on average 18-19% in interest, so they're getting paid ripped off on the interest. And so they stop making payments. And so that's now happening, but that's happening in a very, it's what I call the slimy underbelly of auto business, you know, these specialized, subprime auto dealers and lenders. And two of those subprime auto dealers and lenders are two chains. Each had about 40 stores in the United States. Now, they have blown up now, and they were owned by private equity firms. And so in the last, you know, just this week we had one blow up, and a couple of months, a month ago, we had another one blow up, and they just shut down. And so because customers, you know, they got ripped off, they can't make those payments, you know, they're paying $6,000 more per vehicle than they should, and they're paying, you know, 10% more than they should on the interest, and 10 percentage points more than they should. Yeah, they're just getting ripped off all around. And they, you know, they just walk away from all of this. And so that's where we have a problem now, and yeah, that's always very predictable. It's, you know, when I was in the car business running a big Ford store, you know, we refused to get into this business because it's just a slimy business here, and it's just terrible. It's an unsavory part of the business, and that is now getting hit hard. These subprime auto loans were securitized into bonds, into asset-backed securities, and sold to investors. Now they're facing big losses on those, and so they have stepped back from the market. They're not buying those loans, those bonds anymore, You know, I think that's a good thing that this part of the business is blowing up. It's just slimy, and so it needs to go away. I don't think that will impact the overall car business. This is a small part here. The United States has only $250 billion or so in subprime auto loans outstanding, out of the $1.7 trillion in total auto loans and leases. So it's a pretty small. So it'd be, it's in that part. In terms of being a canary in the coal mine for mortgages, I don't see that yet. You know, during the financial crisis here, subprime mortgage lending was a big problem, and that blew up. This time around, the government is backing these loans. You know, the government has started, rolling out special programs for subprime rated customers and years ago, you know, and so it's the taxpayer that's on the hook, so not the banks. And so if these loans blow up, you know, it's the government, the taxpayer is going to pay for them and not the banks. And so we won't have that cycle of bank failures due to these subprime mortgages. So that's one of the big differences. And I really have seen the kind of abuses in subprime mortgages that we saw, before the financial crisis. I mean, there may be some, but it's not been as bad. And surely there will be some blowups. But right now, home prices are still fairly high in the United States. So people who bought a house, a year ago or earlier, you know, they can still sell the house and pay off, the loan. And so, you know, that will be the first solution to the problem. If you cannot make the payment anymore, you just sell the house. And for most people, they can do so, and many of them can walk away with some extra cash when they do that. So I don't see that as a problem right now. We won't have a problem with mortgages until home prices drop far enough and stay there long enough. And we're not anywhere near that, you know, which is home prices just started dropping last year. So we've got long ways to go for us to get there. Canada is ahead of us. Home prices are down much more in Canada than they're here. But still, there's just a very small number of people that bought homes that are now underwater. And most of the people that bought homes 2 years ago are still fine. You know, they still have cash. They still have equity. And so I think there's still, you know, we've got some time before this becomes an issue.
Is the manufacturer's suggested retail price of new vehicles likely to remain high? And then as the market softens, are new vehicle prices likely to receive discounts?
Yeah, so I've been screaming about new vehicle pricing for years. And manufacturers, what they have done is they have maximized the profit margins. And the profit margins are much bigger in large vehicles and in expensive vehicles. So everybody from Kia on up, they have gone upscale. And so we no longer have the typical entry-level vehicle in the United States. Everything is pretty nice and up from there. And so we've had this situation where, you know, the average American can no longer buy a new vehicle. And they have to buy a used vehicle. And used vehicle prices, of course, have gone up too. So that's getting tough. And so manufacturers are now running out of customers. And that's happened over years, you know. So we had a peak in sales in the year 2000. And then, you know, sales plunged. And then they didn't go back to those levels until like 2016, and you know, from 16 years ago, earlier, and then they fell off again from there. So, you know, the vehicle volume sales have completely matured, and it's not coming up, and it's going down from where they were 20 years ago, and simply because people can no longer afford new vehicles. And automakers are having to do some soul searching. And so now what we have is Tesla. And Tesla has had the biggest profit margins in the auto industry, so they could cut prices because, you know, they're very high profit margins, and they have cut prices. So they're out there, and they cut prices one time, and then another time, and then another time. And these are nice cars. These are upscale cars. They're not entry-level vehicles. And they're forcing other automakers to follow. And Tesla has built factories, is still building factories all over the place. It is so profitable that it is using its cash flow to build those factories. It's not even borrowing money. It's sitting on $22 billion in cash. You know, I mean, it's kicking butt out there, and it's bringing online a huge production capacity, and it's cutting prices. And the more it produces, the lower its per vehicle production costs are, because its volume goes up. And you know, it put pressure first on other EV manufacturers, like GM, cut the price on its Bolt EV now below $30,000. So that's cheap for a new vehicle. You know, average new vehicle transaction price for all new vehicles is $48,000 in the United States. You know, so something that sells for $29,000 is considered cheap. You know, and the lowest model Tesla you can buy sells below $40,000. These are very nice cars, and so other automakers will have to respond, even with the internal combustion engines, because one of the benefits or one of the advantages they had over EVs was price. You know, they were cheaper, but now it's turned. EVs are cheaper than internal combustion engine vehicles. And so, you know, you have this dynamic going on. You've got Tesla, which everybody brushed off for years, you know, building one factory after another. And in the United States, you know, in Europe, in China, and in Mexico. And you know, and it's just, you know, constantly announces new factories. And And so I think there will be huge pressure on prices going forward because new vehicle automakers have lost their customers. They have outpriced their customers. And so we've got the new kid on the block that say, no, we don't play this game. We want to be a mass producer. We've got lots of money. We've got big profit margins. Our vehicles have lower production costs than yours, so we can cut our prices. And so I think over the next few years, what we will see is actually a rollback of those crazy new vehicle prices we have seen. And automakers may respond by piling on discounts or rebates or some other incentives as they usually do, or eventually they may reduce the sticker prices like Ford has done with its EV. Ford has followed Tesla in some of the price cuts on the electric vehicles. And of course, Ford doesn't have any kind of production capacity with EVs. It cannot produce enough. It doesn't have the capacity. It's years behind Tesla. You know, it's still trying to get its supply chain put together. GM has hardly nothing. You know, it has the Bolt that's older EV has been selling for years, and it can't get any of its new vehicles online fast enough. So we have this problem of not having enough capacity, but Tesla is building it out very rapidly, and it has a lot of capacity online now, and so this will, you know, adding capacity to production in the auto industry is a sign that prices will come down, and so that's I'm going out on a limb maybe saying this, but I think Tesla is forcing them to, and that's a great thing. The whole auto industry I think went down a wrong path in raising prices and going upscale on everything, And I think they're going to regret that pretty soon.
What's the latest in the used vehicle market?
Well, used vehicle auction prices have now gone up for the fourth month in a row. And, you know, they plunged at first. So we had this huge spike in 2021, and it spiked 40%. And then they dropped on the wholesale side and auctions, you know, a bunch. And so now they've come up, and they've dropped a bunch, but they've dropped only like a quarter of the price spike. So they unwound only about a quarter of the price spike of the prior year. And so now they've come up, and retail prices have plunged for a year. And so now we saw the first sign of retail prices bottoming out on used vehicles. We saw the first uptick in not seasonally adjusted used vehicle prices in March, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that's our inflation indices. And there's relatively low supply of used vehicles, and they're still constrained by new vehicle supply being constrained by the chip shortages for a couple of years now. So there's limited supply coming into the used vehicle market. Sales are not very high at these high prices, but there's no supply either. So there's plenty of demand for dealers to try to stock up. But, you know, they haven't got the auction to do that. And so they're bidding up prices there. So I think used vehicle prices on the retail side have dropped as far as they're going to drop. It looks like they're now turning around and maybe headed higher again. I mean, we were talking about inflation a minute ago. This is another thing, you know, that has driven down inflation is the drop in used vehicle prices. And it is now essentially ended. And we may see price increases in used vehicles going forward.
Wolf, how can people follow you?
WolfStreet.com. It's free. There's no paywall. Nothing to sign up. Just come to WolfStreet.com.
Wolf, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Wolf Richter, publisher of WolfStreet.com. He was speaking to us from San Francisco. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Martin Straith, and Wolf Richter. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for our guests or the show, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Now stand by for a company showcase update from Recyclico CEO Zarko Masalgia. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen. Welcome to Company Showcase, an advertising feature on HowStreet.com.
I'm Jim Goddard. I'm speaking with Zarko Masalgia, Chief Executive Officer of Recyclico. Welcome back to Company Showcase.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Zarko, the company put out a news release recently. What was in it?
Yeah, we had last week actually we had a fantastic press release where we received industry validation on our recycled end product, and that came from a battery materials company. You know, this is not the first time we received this kind of validation, but we are under many NDAs and cannot disclose the name. But as mentioned in the press release, we have been collaborating together since early 2022. And that has been on the mission to demonstrate the advanced capabilities of the Recyclico process. Now, like I said, this is not the first time an industry player has used our material to make lithium-ion battery cells and validate its performance. But, you know, every time it does happen, it speaks volumes on our technical lead and the pipeline of collaboration work that is growing. Now, on the last podcast, I talked a lot about our business model and how critical of a role the technical due diligence aspect plays in the formation of strategic partnerships, and which we are actually actively working on, as this press release and many before it indicate. The steps we take are always focused on moving us closer to multiple joint ventures with strategic partners. And, this is not just looking at, you know, exploring technology, but, you know, it's all for a commercial purpose to grow the technology and the company. Now, that's the update on the press release, but, you know, there has been a lot of industry news. I feel like every week or, you know, every few weeks there's something major going on, but, you know, to highlight a few, I want to include Canada's aggressive move to keep pace with the financial incentives provided by the U.S., you know, where the Canadian government has agreed to subsidies that could be as high as $13 billion over the next decade. And that was, you know, to even encourage Volkswagen to build its first gigafactory outside of Europe. Now, you know, Canada, as we know, is a resource-rich country, but efforts like these do grow Canada's advanced manufacturing clean technology sector alongside its mining sector. And from the battery recycling perspective, we look to integrate our technology where the batteries will be. So a growing industry here closer to home is always good news for us. And, you know, even we see the aggressive investments continue even on the Korean government side, where they recently announced full support for Korean companies to be more competitive in the high tech industry. And they're committing, you know, an investment of $15.1 billion. And this includes next generation batteries, mineral processing, and even waste batteries and solutions for around waste batteries. But that not just on the government side, but even in industry, with other big players, we're seeing, Apple's announcement that its batteries would also use 100% recycled cobalt beginning in 2025. But just as a quick side note, you know, from a material standpoint, portable electronics primarily use lithium-ion batteries that are an LCO chemistry, which is, you know, short for lithium cobalt oxide. So they only contain lithium and cobalt. Unlike electric vehicles, they get much more complex with various compositions of nickel, manganese, cobalt, and lithium. It makes me think, there is the cobalt recycling component of it, but I would be interested to know what their plans are for recycled lithium content. But, you know, given the current commercial recycling processes available, which would be more of a high heat process, lithium is burned into a slag material and not effectively recovered. But I will note that we have successfully tested these different cathode materials, such as the LCO used in portable electronics and the NMC used in electric vehicle batteries. And we have been able to recover the nickel, manganese, cobalt, but also the lithium and to a battery ready level. And with all this, I think with all the industry news going around, I think it says a lot about where the energy economy is going and how the battery recycling industry plays an important role for decades to come, or plays an important role now and will play an important role for decades to come. But, I think one great source for seeing where these things are going is looking at Tesla's Master Plan 3, right? In their Master Plan 3, there's a lot of interesting information, but I did just want to quickly highlight the recycling section where they say in the 2040s, recycling will begin to play meaningful reduction of primary materials, or they'll begin to meaningfully reduce primary material demand. Now, just to put this in perspective, right now we're seeing, how many mining companies there are, how many mines are coming online to help the support and ramp the manufacturing that's needed. And to think that, in my lifetime, that I'll see these end of life volumes of everything being manufactured approach a total demand volume, and the way we'll view our future resource extraction can completely change from this perspective of mined ores to now urban mining and recycled end of life materials. So, I'm really optimistic for what's to come. And I think, there's going to be, just like there is many mining companies now, I think there'll be a lot of, recycling in many different industries. And I think having advanced and scaled technology is going to be really important.
Sarko, for people new to Recycloco, what does the company do and how can they get more information about it?
Yeah, Recycloco is a battery materials company focused on recycling and upcycling lithium-ion battery waste and recovering materials such as lithium, nickel, manganese, and cobalt to be reused in new lithium-ion battery manufacturing. And you can get a hold of us or look at more information on our website at www.recycloco.com. And we are traded on we're a publicly traded company, traded on the Toronto Venture Exchange under the ticker symbol AMY, on the OTCQB under AMYZF, and on the Frankfurt Stock Exchange under ID4.
Sarko, thank you so much for the update.
Thank you, Jim.
We've been speaking with Sarko Masalgia, Chief Executive Officer of Recycloco. I'm Jim Goddard. Our conversation took place on April 21st.
Comments made on Company Showcase are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at HowStreet.com. Company Showcase is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.